everyone. Today, we bring you our Tainted Love double feature as we watch both versions of The Other Boleyn Girl, the 2003 BBC TV movie and the 2008 feature film production. The BBC version is directed by Philippa Lothrop, stars Natasha McElhone, Jodie May, Jared Harris, and Stephen McIntosh. The 2008 is directed by Justin Chadwick. It stars Natalie Portman, Scarlett Johansson, and Eric Bana, with special appearances from the Twin Loves of My Life, Benedict Cumberbatch, and Eddie Redmayne. So, quick synopsis.
Okay, guys, we're back in 10th grade world history class. Sort of.
Those were good days for me.
Henry VIII is mad because he needs a son to secure the Tudor dynasty's survival and make sure the country doesn't have another civil war, which is how his father, Henry VII, came to power.
Usurper.
He's the accountant king. He and his wife, Queen Catherine of Aragon, don't have a surviving son. Along comes the sneaky, scheming Boleyn family. They sneaky scheme to get Henry interested in either of the Boleyn daughters, Mean Girl Anne or Married Lady Sad Sack Mary. One of these girls will give him male babies, and then he'll be so happy that the families will rise in power and prestige. Sad Sack Mary wins Henry's favor and falls in love with him. Her husband conveniently disappears and or dies from illness.
I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Depending on whether you watch the 2008, he disappears, or the 2003, he dies.
Which actually tracks, considering that it's Benedict Cumberbatch playing him in the 2008.
This is very true. Then Mean Girl Anne, who's been banished for getting it on with the heir to the Duke of Northumberland.
Actually, he's the Earl of Northumberland, but Philippa Gregory gonna Philippa Gregory.
Yeah, I'm saying what she wrote. Anyway, Mean Girl Anne boss babes herself onto the scene, making Henry fall in love with her and marry her. And he also has to forget all about Sad Sack Mary and her new baby boy. Anne has a really horrible miscarriage, but she also knows that if Henry finds out, her number is up. She tries to get her brother to impregnate her.
Bow chicka wow wow.
In the 2008, they don't actually do it. In the 2003, they do. It doesn't work, but they also get found out. So both Anne and George and like every other dude she's ever even talked to gets their head chopped off.
The guy who once sold her a pack of gum is like, damn it!
Hilariously, in the 2003 BBC version, they just show modern-day footage of the site of her execution. In the 2008, we get to see Scarlett Johansson finally realize that Henry VIII is a bad guy. So, she steals baby future Queen Elizabeth I to raise in the countryside, while the entire English court just stands there and lets her?
Yeah, that's cool. Just take her.
It tracks. And this is Sad Sack Mary's big empowerment moment. She has surpassed her sister. She is the one true girl boss. The end.
So, first impressions, because it's really hard to tell what Laura might have thought of this movie.
I know at some point in my life, like, every bookstore started having 50 kajillion copies of the book, along with the other popular chick lit of the time, like Memoirs of a Geisha. And just like with Titanic, it occupied literally 0% of my mental real estate until you brought up watching it for the podcast.
I have a lot to answer for.
Yes, you do. Now that I've seen them both, I can say that both productions are so boring and super cringy in their own different, but equally terrible ways.
I have a confession to make. So, once upon a time, I was really just an American history nerd. Revolution, Civil War, whatever. And then the summer of 2008, I was very unemployed, and I was very bored. And my primary entertainment was going to the grocery store and reading the magazines for free. I'm sorry to the Giant Eagle in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. And I happened to pick up a copy of this book. And I didn't know what I didn't know, and I thought it was great. And
oh, my child, you have much to answer for, indeed.
I thought it was great. It was a compelling read, and that was a gateway drug for me to learn a whole lot more about British history and get really into it, the result of which was learning just how terrible the history is in that book and in every subsequent Philippa Gregory book. But this is the confession that I've been keeping from you, that I have a long, long history with this whole franchise. So let's get down to the heart of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
The main historical source text that Philippa Gregory cites for The Other Boleyn Girl was a 1989 book by Aretha Warnick, who's a history professor at Arizona State, and who's actually publicly distanced herself from both the novel and the movies, which is pretty funny. But nevertheless, she makes a bunch of claims that are not, shall we say, as kindly as possible, substantiated by the available evidence, and that make their way into first the book and then one or both of the movies. To start, she's working with a birth date for Anne of 1507, which would have made her 19 or 20 at the time her relationship with Henry began, and she's working off a theory that Mary's the younger sister, which would have made her, like, 12 or 13. Most historians now think that Anne was born around 1501 and that Mary was the older of the two sisters, most likely born in 1499, which makes them young when they take up with Henry, but not, like, creepy, uncomfortably young. But Warnick's greatest influence on the other Boleyn girl is the picture that she paints of scandal and skin and... Could be both.
Scandal and sin swirling
around Anne in her last months.
Apparently there's a lot of flesh.
So much flesh. She asserts that Anne's last miscarriage in January 1536 was as a severely deformed fetus, and that that really set Anne up for her eventual downfall, since at the time that would have been indication to the early modern mind of sin and shame and witchcraft and everything else. Now, if this had actually happened, it would have absolutely been mentioned in the records of her trial, the reports of the various ambassadors and observers at court who were kind of standing around rooting for her fall. They would have jumped on this accusation. But they don't. Likewise, with Dr. Warnick's claim that George Boleyn was gay and that he was part of a ring of other men at court who were all having sex with one another, this is an assertion that's completely without evidence, isn't found anywhere else. The Boleyn's enemies would have fallen on it like a pack of dogs on a three-legged cat if there were any suggestion. But she really uses this idea, which isn't at all substantiated, to set up the idea that Anne is surrounded by this morass of immorality, and that's why they were able to take her down.
It's a stew of sin.
And skin. And now, Dr. Warnick might be a very accomplished historian in some ways, but she definitely helped contribute to popularizing some lurid myths about the Boleyn siblings that go way beyond Cromwell's wildest, weirdest dreams. And it's those myths that really form the basis of the other Boleyn girl and give it its drama and the impetus to its plot. So what do we actually know about Mary Boleyn? Well, not much, because she's a woman living in the early 1500s. But we know that she spent some time at the French court, and that it's likely that she had a short-lived but very quiet affair with King Francis while she was there. Her marriage in 1520 to William Carey, again, took place when she was 19 or 20, not 12 or 13. It's made out in the movies like it's not a very impressive match. Like, we kind of threw Mary away on the poor relation while we wait to make a grand marriage for Anne. Well, that's not really accurate. The marriage to William Carey was considered to be a brilliant one. He's a third cousin to King Henry. His grandmother was the sister of Henry's grandfather on the Beaufort side, and Henry, of course, is very close to his Beaufort relatives. William Carey's very close to the king, so this is considered to be a brilliant, very advantageous match for Mary. Now, far from what's usually depicted in any movie about Henry VIII, he was pretty discreet about his affairs. He was very into the idea of courtly love and chivalry. He tends to court a lady from afar, keep things quiet. It's difficult to know exactly when his relationship with Mary began. As best we can tell, it probably was sometime in 1522, which is the same year that her daughter Catherine was born. Alison Weir makes the case in her very good biography of Mary Boleyn, which is the only full-length biography of her that exists, that the preponderance of evidence points to Catherine having been Henry's biological daughter, but not her younger brother, Henry. Henry was born after the affair had waned, and in any case, I think anybody who spent, like, 10 seconds reading about Henry VIII knows that he would have moved heaven and earth and everything else if he'd actually had a biological son to recognize and legitimize that son and secure his throne.
Dr. Susan Bordeaux starts off her book, The Creation of Anne Boleyn, A New Look at England's Most Notorious Queen, talking about how when Henry decided to execute Anne, he decided to destroy anything associated with her. Her letters, portraits of her, her coat of arms that were put up all over his residences, And when we were at Hampton Court Palace last summer, we were able to see one of the intertwined H&A carvings in the Great Hall that had been overlooked.
Bet that carpenter got a really bad review that year.
Ye old Yelp. And it wasn't until Elizabeth became queen that Anne supporters could talk openly and reminisce about her. As a result, there's a lot about Anne that's been lost to history. Exactly what she looked like, her likes, her dislikes, even her specific birthday, as what you said. Bordeaux describes Anne as, quote, a shape-shifting trickster whose very incompleteness in the historical record has stirred the imaginations of different agendas, different generations, and different cultural moments to lay claim to their own Boleyn. In cutting her life so short and then ruthlessly disposing of the body of evidence of her real existence, Henry made it possible for her to live 100 different lives forever, end of quote. Bordeaux spends a lot of time talking about this afterlife, and how academia and fiction have portrayed her throughout each era. Some fictional depictions are based more on the zeitgeist of the times, such as being portrayed kind of like a flapper in the 1920s. Anne's a modern woman who's bold, brassy, and sassy, and whoopsie, she's gotten herself into a pickle.
Well, that's the cat's pajamas.
But historically speaking, there have been two major debates on how to depict Anne that started from when she was alive and that have trickled down throughout all this interpretation. We're talking about that age-old virgin whore divide. Was Anne the most virtuous, prettiest, saintliest Protestant martyr that her fellow English reformers claimed she was? With such books like Extracts from the Life of the Virtuous, Christian and Renowned Queen Anne Boleyn, or was she an evil, scheming, deformed, evil witch hag who destroyed the country with her evil sex magic and spent all day trying to kill Catherine of Aragon and Mary Tudor?
Also with evil sex magic.
Whoa. Like what Eugene Chapuis, the Holy Roman Emperor's ambassador to England, claimed.
So let's start with the most dramatic accusation. Did Anne actually sleep with her brother George?
Bow, bow, chick, bow, chick, bow, bow, bow.
Now you can never say you haven't heard Greensleeves rendered as baby-making music. But that's what the BBC version oh so awkwardly depicts, which comes straight from the other Boleyn Girl book. Anne is certainly accused of this among her other crimes, and she's found guilty of the charge of incest at her trial. This is in the category of things that we will never know 100% for sure, but that are pretty much 99.9999999999% likely to be false. Accusing Anne of sleeping with George was a way to make sure that she was taken down for good. Anne was never all that popular, but Henry had gone to a lot of trouble to make her queen, and he remembered vividly how the common people had turned out to defend Catherine of Aragon, and he couldn't be sure that they wouldn't take a wild hair and stand up for Anne as well. So destroying her with the most heinous accusation he could muster seemed like the move. It's also not clear whether it was really Henry or Cromwell who was directing events at this point, but accusing George along with Anne was guaranteed to cripple the powerful Boleyn faction at court. Moreover, she and George wouldn't have really had the opportunity to fornicate together. Unlike what we see in both versions of this movie, royals at this time of history are never, ever alone. They don't bathe alone, they don't poop alone, they don't sleep alone, they don't do anything alone. The queen would have had a maid assigned to sleep in her room every night, which hopefully she didn't snore. There would have always been servants in the background who could have very easily been bought off by foreign diplomats or just nosy courtiers who wanted to get the inside scoop. So even if Anne was even tempted to do it with George, they both would have been savvy enough to know that there was no chance they were ever going to get away with this. And the punishment would have been horrific, and the eternal damnation would have been even worse. And there's just, we're never going to know for sure, but it does not pass the historical smell test. Kind of like Henry's festering leg wound. Save that for another time.
Thanks. When doing a historiographical analysis, you have to look at the biases and merits of primary and secondary sources. Both Anne supporters and detractors had their own agendas. The reformers wanted a saint, ironically, and a poster girl for their religious cause, and they were willing to turn a blind eye to things that she did that were seen as less virtuous, such as helping break up a marriage, making very thin-veiled complaints about how she would love to get Mary Tudor out of the way, wink, wink, and being more outspoken and demanding of her husband than what was acceptable at the time. This was seen as a major breach of natural order. On the flip side, Chapuis' boss, the Holy Roman Emperor, was Catherine of Aragorn's... Sorry. Catherine of Aragon's nephew.
When your nerddoms get crossed with each other.
Yes. And Chapuis was also writing to Spanish audiences. Additionally, Spain and France were major rivals, and Anne was essentially a walking, talking billboard for all things French, including England's diplomatic relations with France. Of course he's not going to like her for that alone. Though, to be honest, sometimes his stuff reads like she's Regina George and he's Katie Heron obsessing over her.
I heard her sixth finger is insured for 10,000 shillings.
Hans Holbein once met her on a barge and he said that she was doth comely. But as you and Dr. Bordeaux point out, what's depicted in the other Boleyn girl is like Chapuis on steroids and cocaine. Also, I do need to credit Dr. Bordeaux with calling the Natalie Portman version Mean Girl Anne in the synopsis. That was not me. But she's cruel to everyone, she's cold, and she's Kathleen, and she's out only for herself, regardless of what it takes.
So once she gets her head cut off, what happens to everyone else? Mary Boleyn lived out the rest of her life in comfortable obscurity. She dies in 1543.
But did she steal baby Queen Elizabeth?
The record is curiously silent on that point.
It's just because she was a woman.
Absolutely. So her daughter Catherine, who may or may not have also been Henry's daughter, married Sir Francis Knollys and became chief lady of the bedchamber to her cousin and potential half-sister, Queen Elizabeth I. Catherine Carey had at least 15 children.
Oh my gosh, jeez.
One at least. One of whom, Lettice, eventually became the second wife of Elizabeth I's notorious favorite, Robert Dudley. Catherine's grandson, Thomas, Baron de la Warr, was an investor and military leader in the colonization of Virginia. The state of Delaware is named for him, and he went on to introduce John Rolfe and his wife Pocahontas to London society, later to be covered in our review of Pocahontas 2, Journey to the New World. To a new world. To a world. Ultimately, and hold on to your hats here, Mary Boleyn is a direct ancestor through Catherine's assorted 8 million children, of Queen Elizabeth II, King Charles III, Kate Middleton, and Princess Diana. Meanwhile, Mary's son Henry was another great favorite of his cousin Elizabeth I. He served at various times as the master of her hawks and the captain of her personal bodyguard. I wish he'd found a way to combine those roles. Hawks would be an awesome bodyguard. When Henry died in 1596, Elizabeth paid for this magnificent 36-foot high tomb for him. It's still the tallest memorial in Westminster Abbey. You can still see it there, and if you look carefully, it has the telltale three bull heads of the Boleyn family crest on it. Now, Mary's second husband, William Stafford, he married again about a decade after her death. And his second wife, irony of ironies, was the granddaughter of Lady Margaret Pole, famous as Henry VIII's oldest victim, who was executed at the age of 67. She's the lady who got up from the block and tried to run from the headsman, and he chased her around and hacked at her until she collapsed from loss of blood. Big fan of hers.
Basically, there have only really been, at any point in time, 5 English people, and they're all related to each other 12 ways over.
I'm getting that.
Yeah.
It makes things complicated and fun. So now we come to the big question. How many Claire's headband version of the French hood are we awarding to the other Boleyn girls?
It's gonna be one terrible French hood for me. I would have given both of these productions a 0.
I expected that.
Yeah, but at least they had both a few good examples of women's headwear. Even though the movies are framed differently and have wildly different budgets, aka the 2003 BBC TV version had no budget, it's just strange to me that they are both so weirdly myopic in their world building. I mean, maybe the BBC version didn't think they needed to go over stuff that's so integral to British history, but like the English Reformation, all the legal proceedings with the divorce, basically don't even happen. In the 2008, we do see Queen Catherine testifying in court, and then later Natalie Portman does the same for her treason trial, but we don't really get much context at all. The scenes just kind of happen, and then they're over. But moreover, nothing's compelling, nothing's interesting, there's no real drama or suspense. The main actors did nothing to make you interested in their characters, and they don't disappear into their characters either. 2008 is basically Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson. Mean Natalie and ScarJo and really bad costumes. The 2003 was Natasha McElhone, devoid of any emotion regardless of the situation. And the Guardian Review from back then says that, quote unquote, she's about as wet and passive as a dead halibut. Jodie May failed to capture any of Anne's noted charm and sophistication. She just moves about like this slouching, awkward 14-year-old. Dr. Bordeaux says that she's most notable for the, quote, excited deep heaving of her bosom, which never let up no matter what was happening in the plot. Excited, heave, heave. Anxious, heave, heave. Plotting, heave, heave. Awaiting her beheading, heave, heave, heave. End quote. But also, I really don't like how the 2008 shows Henry immediately hating Anne after their marriage. It's a 180 turn. He's going to turn this minivan right back around. If your kids don't shut up, no one's going to Disney World. It's wildly historically inaccurate, as it's established that he was smitten with her until very close to the end.
I will turn this summer progress around. But yeah, it's not just historically inaccurate. It's really lazy storytelling. I feel like the writers for both of these movies went to the tell-don't-show school of screenwriting.
They had nothing else in the budget.
But when the BBC version was made, the British version of The Office was the big new thing, which I guess is why they decided to break the fourth wall, like, every 10 minutes, so the characters could provide a summary of whatever you had just seen happen on the screen. If these cutaways had provided literally any insight into the characters' thoughts or motivations, they might have been helpful. Instead, it's just, hey, let me recount exactly what you just saw happen. I also need to point out that the entire movie looked like it was filmed on someone's home video camera circa 1997.
I think it was.
While this may have had some embarrassingly low production values, it pales in comparison to the hot mess that is the American version, where just everybody's bumbling around all the time, talking loudly about feelings that they never seem to actually be feeling. Scarlett Johansson is all but catatonic most of the time. Natalie Portman is the manic pixie dream girl of the 1530s, and even the greatest actor of our generation, Benedict Cumberbatch, cannot do anything at all with the material he's given. I am awarding both of these disasters a combined one French hood that has been thrown down in the soiled rushes on the castle floor and kicked around for a while and then chewed by one of Henry's dogs. Oh, it's so bad. So bad. So finally, we come to a few sundry other notes.
I don't even remember if it's mentioned at all in the 2003 version.
I think you fell asleep at this point, but go on.
Yeah, I was on my phone. But basically in the 2008, the English Reformation is just Natalie Portman whining halfway through the movie about how it's so unfair. Henry shouldn't let the Pope boss him around.
We should just kill Caesar.
Just so you know, it was a lot more complicated than just this. While Henry broke England away from the Roman Catholic Church so he could marry Anne, there are already plenty of theologians urging reform regarding the scope of the church's authority and government. Well, you've probably heard Martin Luther protesting selling indulgences by nailing his 95 theses on a church door. There had been some reform movements before and happening at the same time. And Anne Boleyn was actually getting to witness the debates that were starting to emerge. For example, when she was a lady-in-waiting for Queen Claude in France, not as a punishment for banging Henry Percy, but because this, at the time, was the equivalent of finishing school for prominent young ladies, she was introduced to the philosophical salons that Marguerite de Navarre held that discussed religious reform issues. And there was a lot of debate within the English Reformation. It wasn't like, we've split from Rome and now we're all modern-day evangelicals. Henry was basically happy just replacing the Pope as being the head of the church, while other people, like his wife number 6, Catherine Parr, wanted to make more changes, such as focusing on the individual's capacity for reading and interpreting scripture for themselves. Side note, he got so mad with her over this that she almost got taken to the Tower. Anne in particular disagreed with Henry and Thomas Cromwell's decision to turn over church money and gold and lands to the crown. She wanted it to be distributed for charity.
Not to be the skunk at the garden party, but that's kind of what the church was already using it for. But I digress. Y'all are used to hearing us keep track of which actors make repeat appearances on the podcast, which is really just a catalog of who has the best resting historical face. But I am super excited to have a repeat location turn up. The American version filmed Catherine of Aragon's trial at London's oldest surviving parish church, St. Bartholomew the Great, which dates to the year 1123. It's standing in here for the long-lost Blackfriars Monastery, but we last saw it as anti-slavery crusader John Newton's church in the film Amazing Grace. I give the American version a lot of credit for filming in some pretty cool locations. In no particular order, they include Ely Cathedral, where construction was begun in the year 1023, Laycock Abbey, which was a nunnery, dissolved in 1539 by guess who?
No clue.
Dover Castle, which you might recall from our season 3 preview, is a favorite of mine, and which serves really well here as the Tower of London. And Penshurst Place, which today is maintained as an example of a typical upper-class family home in the late medieval, early modern period. The only filming location for the BBC version is Berkeley Castle, which they also use for a couple scenes in the American version.
Excuse you, I think they green-screened Anne in at Heber for the BBC version.
I guess they get credit for that. Berkeley Castle is primarily famous as the place where King Edward II was murdered with a burning hot poker up the bum. I do want to throw a shout out, since Laura brings it up, to Hever Castle, which was Anne and Mary's childhood home in the countryside south of London. Today, there was very little left of the home that they knew. The castle was bought in the early 20th century by the Astor family, pretty much gutted it. To quote the Dowager Countess, why does every Dane involve a fight with an American? But today, Hever's curatorial staff do a really impressive job of interpreting what they have left to work with. They just kicked off a new exhibit, Catherine and Anne, Queens, Rivals, Mothers. It focuses not on the differences between Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, but on their similarities, especially as women of deep religious faith. Hever's curatorial team, Dr. Owen Emerson and Dr. Kate McCaffrey, are both on Instagram, and they do a lot of showcasing, not just of the exhibit, but of their day-to-day lives, maintaining the castle and sharing its story and poking around its historical bits. And I highly recommend a follow for both of them.
It's not an episode of this podcast unless I get to complain about costumes, so let's go. Not going to focus on the 2003 because they had no budget. It was like community theater level. But in the 2008, there are, as I said, some decent examples here and there of clothing from the time. There are also so many bad costumes. Men wearing boots in non-horse riding, non-fighting, non-outdoorsy settings.
It's called fashion. Look it up.
Check. French hoods that are giant, puffy headbands and not actually hoods. Check. 1850s crinoline-shaped skirts. Check. Bright green dress, the color of which was just about impossible to make in the 1500s. Check, check, check.
Do you consider that the headband people are just trying to be Instagram makeup influencers?
Click the link in the bio! But the most baffling to me is Anne's riding outfit. She's wearing an extremely East German-looking affair. Paying sleeves, slashed bodice, hair snood, fancy hat. This plus the dress ScarJo was wearing in that scene are basically copies of outfits worn by women in the work of official court of Saxony painter Lucas Cranach, who was painting during that time period. But here's the problem. Nobody in England dressed like that. When Anne of Cleves showed up wearing the fashions from her homeland, which is on the border of what's now Germany and the Netherlands, this helped cement her reputation for being hideous. Anne was known for being very fashionable, but moreover, very French.
Oui, oui.
There's no way she would wear this German stuff.
So finally, where have I seen that guy before, which I am exercising my authority to rename Resting Historical Face? I was really thrilled to have both of my, capital letters, slightly odd-looking British posh boy crushes show up in this episode. Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays William Carey in the American version of the movie, was last seen as Sherlock Holmes in Sherlock. I guess, and is William Pitt the Younger in Amazing Grace. Eddie Redmayne is making his first, but not, I suspect, his last appearance on the pod, playing William Stafford. The iconic British actress Kristin Scott Thomas makes her second appearance, playing Elizabeth Boleyn.
She is really too prestige for that movie.
She is. We last saw her in Gosford Park. We also have a couple of extra extras. James Fiddy plays a random nobleman here, but he was Roman soldier and gladiator. Phil Lowes rides around here doing things on horseback in this movie and in Titanic.
No.
Oh,
gladiator?
That's not right. He's just riding around the hold of the ship, peeking in on Jack and Rose. So, doing things on horseback here and in Gladiator, which honestly feels like a solid career move. And finally, John Simmet, who's an extra here, played a Titanic crew member.
And, more importantly, he is the voice of Dipsy in the Teletubbies.
Truly a historic something moment. I got nothing. Thanks for listening to Costume Drama Rewind. We have enjoyed bringing you our Tainted Love special double episode.
Tainted.
See you next time.